7.07 and 106 FM.
Streaming on the Prime Media Plus app
and on DSTV channel 856.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Midday Report at 12:06. My name is T.D. Madia, standing in for Mandy Wiener. Lots on the go. South Africa is always a busy country. Coming up on the Midday Report today, the Senzo Meyiwa trial continues in the Pretoria High Court. The IEC, as you heard in the Eyewitness News Bulletin, just held a media briefing on the upcoming national elections. The newly elected Ekurhuleni Mayor appointed his mayoral committee yesterday. He will be on the Midday Report. PA leader Gayton McKenzie gives a media update. Western Cape Premier Ellen Windy is also unpacking how the party plans to create 800,000 jobs. Other stories to keep an eye on, though, is that multinational G4S, remember them? And the Department of Correctional Services are battling it out in the Pretoria High Court. This is over the termination of the Mangaung prison contract. Of course, what will come to your mind is Thabo Bester. This is in part because of that. Justice Minister Ronald Lamola deciding to terminate their contract over that particular escape. G4S is likely to make an argument that it's got a good track record. I don't know. Another story to keep an eye on: in the Western Cape, alleged underworld gang boss Nafees Modak is back in the Western Cape High Court. He's got a trial also unfolding. He and 14 other co-accused facing a slew of charges relating to the murder of slain anti-gang unit detective Shal Kinnear. Looking forward to hearing from the Ekurhuleni mayor. He's got a new mayoral committee. Well, if you say new, if you believe new, you're seeing the same faces, the same finance MMCs, but we'll hear from Dr. Kakaza a little bit later.
Walking this talk together.
Every hour.
Every day. This is 702.
Let's walk the talk.
We start now in Pretoria, where we find our reporter Khumutso Modiso, who joins us now on the line. Of course, the Senzo Meyiwa murder trial continues in the High Court. Khumutso, good afternoon and welcome to the show. So yesterday, you told us about Judge Rata Mokgwatleng wanting the head of Legal Aid Board to testify on the funding of a ballistics expert for defense. I also understand a retired warden also took to the stand. So before we even speak about a new witness, let's speak about the retired warden and what he had to tell the court.
Good afternoon, TD. That's right. The retired one did come to take the stand. This is the former head of prison at the Kalagabusha Center. He is the man that discovered the cell phone that has been attributed to accused number five. The state believes that cell phone was used by accused number five during his time at Kalagabusha, where he was detained and awaiting trial for other matters. And, you know, he detailed how he received a call, a private number from a private number who gave him a tip-off, essentially, that there is a cell phone in that cell and he should go and collect it. And he's spoken about how after he collected that cell phone, he then handed it over to the investigators of this case. Now, it is really difficult for the defense to cross-examine him on a lot because his testimony was really, you know, it wasn't really about the contents of the phone. It was just about how he collected the phone from the prison cell. So his testimony was very brief to me.
Do we know when we'll find out the contents from the cell phone, or is it that's put to bed, that witness has done nothing else about that particular cell phone device?
Well, we're actually finding out about the contents of the phone right now.
With the new witness, I'll tell us more.
So what's been happening, I think maybe before we get there, because Lieutenant Colonel Gideon Hose is currently on the stand and he's testifying on that. But what just happened now, Cindy, which took a bit of our time this morning, is that we got that representative from Legal Aid to come and she didn't testify because she wasn't under oath, but she came to address the court on an application that has been made by the defense for the funding of a ballistic expert. So I just want to take you back and our listeners back a bit on what's been happening here with regards to the ballistic expert. The state has had this ballistic expert by the name of Lieutenant Colonel Chris Mayena, very high-profile expert, who came and testified and linked the firearm that was found at the home of accused number three to the murder of Senzo Meyiwa. Now, that evidence remains unchallenged because the defense has been asking for time to consult with their own ballistic experts. And it's been 8 months since Chris Mangena completed his time, or at least completed his evidence in chief on the witness stand. And he's been waiting to be called back to be cross-examined by the defense. Yesterday we learned that the defense just didn't have, or the accused just didn't have enough money to pay this new or their own expert to challenge what Chris Mangena has told the court. They said that they approached legal aid and they were waiting for legal aid to approve their application. But what we've heard right now from a legal aid representative, TD, is that they in fact approached legal aid only 2 weeks ago. And they approached with this application and legal aid told them, please bring us a breakdown, a detailed breakdown of what the cost will actually be. And they haven't gone back to legal aid to give them that breakdown. And so it is very clear that it's been on the part of the defense where there have been major delays with regards to this. And Judge Ramaphosa has reiterated how unacceptable that is, saying that in South Africa, the right to a speedy trial is a constitutional right, and it is the defense that is impeding on that right, the rights of the client to fair trial.
Mm. And then let's speak a little bit about, is this now the new witness where you are now getting into the cell phone contents? Thank you for answering the question around legal aid.
Yes. So what's happening now, TD, is that we've got Lieutenant Colonel Gideon Holmes. He is going to be testifying on the cell phones that were found on accused number two, Bongani Ndanzi, as well as accused number five. You'll remember that yesterday there was testimony that a cell phone was found where Bongani Ndanzi was being detained. That was in February of 2021. That's months after his initial arrest in 2020. He was found with a cell phone in his prison cell. Now, he has completely denied this, and he says that his cell phone was taken upon his arrest in June of 2020. But we're going to be hearing testimony now about what was found on the cell phone that the state belongs to him. Gideon Holmes will also testify on the evidence of the cell phone data that he found from that Stylo cell phone that was found in the prison cell of accused number five. That's the cell phone that was found by the retired warden at Kalagabusha.
All right, thank you so much. That's EWN's Khumutso Modise, who is at the Pretoria High Court watching the Senzo Meyiwa trial as it unfolds. It's an interesting trial. At the heart of it, though, there's a question of justice for the Bafana Bafana captain at that. But it has so many layers, that particular trial. Earlier, I did mention that Nafis Modak, alleged underworld gang boss, is also in trial in the Western Cape. EWN's Carlo Peterson is keeping an eye on that. Keep an ear out for our bulletin. We'll be giving updates throughout the day.
Because this journey is better taken together.
Let's walk the talk. 702.
Onto this story now. The IEC is, I think, probably still holding a media briefing on the election timetable. It speaks to special votes. The applications are now open. The number of voting stations and many other issues in the lead up to the May 29th general elections. Joining me in studio now is Thabiso Goba, EWN reporter, to unpack that a little bit. They are trying to speak about the next few steps in the lead up to the 7th democratic elections. What's been announced by the IEC?
Yes, good afternoon, CD. Well, basically the IEC is saying that, you know, they're very much close to finalizing, you know, everything. They say that about 95% of their logistical issues, of their logistical in terms of you know, stuff has been sorted out. But also, you know, just giving, as I said, just giving some nice statistics in terms of what it looks like. As you said, those final ballots has not been finished because we know there's still some parties at the electoral court, so there's still some decisions. But the IEC is saying that, you know, we now have an idea of what the final ballots will look like. As I said, you know, one of those statistics is that about 58% of the candidates who will be contesting for positions are male, and about 41% are female. So even though female count for more voters,
yes,
when it comes to candidates, unfortunately the male, or fortunately the
it's
male,
unfortunate, but yes, continue.
Unfortunately, the male have obviously about 58% of those. If you're a young person, about 17 candidates, TD, are aged 18. So there will be first-time voters, but also contesting in the elections.
There's representation there. That's interesting.
Yes. On the other side, TD, there are about 17 also candidates who are 80 8 years and older. So obviously,
including former President Jacob Zuma, while the IEC handles that matter in the takes the matter to the Constitutional Court. Well, I don't know if the Q&A session had started. Were there any questions being asked around that particular issue? They are still waiting for judgment from the High Court as to why an order was given for the former president to go ahead. Is there anything on that yet?
I mean, it seems that we can't escape the MK. So, two important things with regards to the MK. So, as I said, the IEC said it's very, it's almost close to finalizing the ballot paper. But obviously, the ballot paper includes the trademark or the logo of the ballot of the political party. Now, we do know that the trademark issue of the Umkhonto-we-Sizwe party is still outstanding. So, the IEC is keeping a close eye on that. Whatever decision happens there, they're going to obviously have to reconfigure their ballot paper depending on the decision that's made by the courts. And secondly, Simon Mabolo did speak about President Zuma and saying that obviously they are not wading into the political issues, but they just want to find clarity on the decision that was made by the electoral courts. But we can listen to what he had to say.
And we have orders in this case. And on the basis of those orders, we think that there's a need for clarity on a number of issues. Did the Commission go beyond its scope of authority in invoking Section 47(1)(e)? We have no clarity as a country on that aspect.
That's the voice of...
Did Commissioner prejudge the issue to extend that she ought to have recused herself? We don't know whether the statement that he made in response to a media question did in fact constitute prejudging the issue. Does remission of sentence amount to the reduction of the sentence as ordered by a court of law? We don't know.
That's the voice of Simon Mabula from the IEC. I was speaking to Tabiso Koba earlier about the IEC's media briefing where they're giving an update on the road towards the May 29th general elections. Interestingly enough, in terms of vote stations that they've set up, KwaZulu-Natal has the highest number of stations, followed by the Eastern Cape and Limpopo. South Africa takes to the polls on the 29th of May.
Walking this talk together.
Every hour.
Every day. This is 702.
Let's walk the talk.
Focusing a bit of our attention on the Western Cape now. Western Cape Premier candidate Alan Windey is unpacking his plan to create 800,000 jobs in the province. He's visiting businesses in Athlone to share his plans. If I remember well, the DA has been boasting that it's been able to create at least 300,000 jobs. So they want to top that up. EWN's Ntuthuzelo Nene is following the Premier. He joins us now. Ntuthuzelo, good afternoon. Welcome to the show. As I said, they had created around 3,000. I see the Premier, who's also up for re-election, is promising even more jobs. I've lost him to Tuzelo for a little bit. He'll come back on. There's a lot of activity that is going on in the Western Cape. You have the Premier candidate, still Premier outgoing, who's out and about. And Tuzelo is back up now. I don't know if you can hear me. I hear he's making big promises. What else is the Premier saying?
Good afternoon, CD. Yes, the Premier did visit the area of Athlone this morning, speaking to young people and, some businesses in the area. It's just a little over a month before we head to the polls, and a lot of political parties are making bold statements and promises, to entice the voters to vote for them. The Premier of the Western Cape saying that their plan is to create 800,000 jobs across the board for people in the Western Cape. And when we asked him if this is not just one of those statements, that political parties are making in this election season. And, you know, if it's not an electioneering ploy, and this is what he had to say.
I think the one thing about the Democratic Alliance and in this campaign is that I've got a track record. So you can look back over the last 5 years, you can look back over the last 15 years, and you can say what has been said and what has been done. And now you have a look at what's being said again. And that's, if I say 800,000 jobs, I mean, that's a stretch. I'm pushing that boundary. But I've got a track record that shows it. The track record behind me shows that businesses come here, they invest here, they enable job creation. And so that's why we have the highest job creation record in the country. And so you've got the credibility of the promises based in the track record.
Ntutuzelo, he is engaging with different business people, I imagine. What are the messages, what are the concerns that they're conveying to Premier Ellen Wendy?
Obviously, people have been affected by the recent COVID pandemic, and people are saying that, you know, they are slowly, you know, trying to get their business back on the feet, and they need more support from government in terms of, you know, creating an environment where businesses can thrive in the Western Cape. And the Premier is saying that you know, the government of the GA in the Western Cape is doing whatever it can to ensure that the Western Cape, you know, is business friendly, where investors can come and invest money here so that jobs can be created, businesses can thrive, and so on and so forth.
Perhaps you can answer this one very quickly. His campaign style, is it very much like the federal leader of the DA? I mean, he would speak about the opposition to the opposition, the parties that he's labeled mercenaries. Does Ellen Wendy speak to the competition that they are facing in the Western Cape? Does he say anything about those who wish to unseat the DA and what they would have on offer when he speaks to the electorate?
The Premier doesn't want to be drawn into all of those things. He's saying that the DA will win. He's confident about that, so he doesn't need to speak about other people. Their message is their message, and it's only driven by what the DA can produce and what the DA has produced since it has been in power in the Western Cape.
All right, thank you so much. That's Ntutuzelo Nene, EWN reporter, following Premier Ellen Wendy, who's on a bid to get re-elected, but most importantly, to create 800 jobs.
Because this journey is better taken together.
Let's walk the talk. 702.
We are staying in the Western Cape, and we now cross to Baba Londenze from EWN, who has been watching another person in the Western Cape trying to unseat the DA. In fact, the Patriotic Alliance and its Western Cape Premier candidate, Gayton McKenzie, held a media briefing this morning. From the alert I saw, the PA has been saying that it wants to make a big announcement about the upcoming elections. Babalo joins us now. Babalo, did he make a big announcement? What's the big reveal coming from the Patriotic Alliance?
Well, I think it will depend on you, on who you are, whether this is a big deal or not, CD, and especially in the Western Cape. But the announcement by Gayton McKenzie was to tell us that, you know, there are a number of other smaller parties from rural towns in the Western Cape, in other municipalities, that are now throwing their weight behind the PA. You know, the PA has presented itself as the alternative for coloured voters in the province. And they have these parties from places like Witzenberg, as well as Oudtshoorn and Prince Albert, that have now joined support for the PA. And they won't be voting for any other party, or they'll be telling their members to rather vote for the PA as opposed to any other party. And, you know, they also announced a few other, you know, policy proposals, you know, during this announcement of these small parties. For example, they're saying that, you know, they need to bring God back into schools. You know, calling on religious leaders, or religion rather, to be inserted back into schools. And they're also saying that 15 years has been too long for this province to be led by the Democratic Alliance. And they're also, you know, predicting that the DA will be dropping below 40% in the 30s, according to Gayton McKenzie, when it comes to the vote in the Western Cape. And the PA is also predicting internally within the party, they claim that they have a 20% or 24% rather vote for the province, and they will be the kingmaker. So they basically announcing that, you know, time is up for the DA in the Western Cape. They've got all these parties pledging their allegiance to the PA, and they also will be campaigning, you know, in not just coloured areas, also he made it quite clear, CD, that, you know, the PA might be, you know, pushing for, you know, interests that, you know, affect coloured communities. But it's not just the coloured party. Black people are also more than welcome in the PA. In fact, members of the PA, some of them are black people, and they have offices and branches in Inyanga and Kukuletu and Khayelitsha. And so, you know, a rallying call by Gayton McKenzie in the province that, you know, let's kick the DA out as all these other small parties. But when we do that, we won't be working with the ANC, because the ANC is all but non-existent in the Western Cape.
So he's attempting to create a bloc to take on the DA. In your assessment, though, how feasible is this? How possible is it to create a bloc that is actually a threat to the party that's in government in the province?
What it looks like, it is a bloc that is, you know, becoming, well, the threat is being felt by the DA, according to McKenzie. He says, you know, funders of the DA in the province have also courted him and the PA not to, you know, contest in the province. And they are saying that, you know, the DA is clearly running scared and is very concerned about losing the majority vote in the province. And they're saying it's also not just, you know, small organizations. He actually says the PA is not a small organization, so the DA can't, you know, lump the PA with other smaller parties or uncontested parties, I beg your pardon, unrepresented parties like Rise and Zansi. He actually says Rise and Zansi is there to steal the DA's lunch as well. But the biggest, you know, threat to the DA is the Patriotic Alliance, as well as this bloc that he's creating with these smaller parties that represent colored communities in many rural areas in the province. And he says he's in the city of Cape Town in the metro because, you know, the metro is one of the DA's strongholds. In fact, it's the DA's strongest, you know, voting section. And he says the reason he's here in the metro is to try now to, you know, kill that vote for the DA and bring it towards the PA, especially, you know, voters that would ordinarily, you know, be from colored communities in the province and in the city of Cape Town.
All right, thank you so much. That's EWN's Baba Londenza. I suppose the only way to truly tell if what Gayton McKenzie is saying is true is when you and I take to the polls and we vote. Very, very interesting things. Earlier, Tabis was speaking about the different stats that are associated with these elections coming from the IEC. So 23,292 voting stations, mostly in KZN. There's about 4,974. Most candidates are between the ages of 40 and 49. There's 52 political parties that are contesting and 58,000 registered voters abroad, 31 new political parties. So there is a lot on the go. Again, there are more male candidates running for these elections than there are women, though there are more female women voters in these elections. What are your thoughts on these stories? We'll have a few more coming up after the news bulletins. You can WhatsApp us on 072-702-1702, 072-567-1567.
Walking this talk together.
Every hour.
Every day. This is 702.
Let's walk the talk.
It's 12:35. You're still listening to the Midday Report. My name is T.D. Madia, standing in for Mandy Wiener. So last week, Ekurhuleni got a new mayor, Dr. Xhakaza. Yesterday, its former mayor, who was voted out last month, made a comeback. Are you following? Do you understand that? So the former mayor has now made a comeback, but this time as an MMC. Sivuyile Ngodwana was announced with nine others as part of the 10-member mayoral committee. The EFF has retained its five MMCs posts, with the Red Berets provincial chair Nkululeko Dunga returning as finance MMC. So when you look at it at face value, the only change that's really happened is the face of the mayor, with now Mayor Dr. Xhakaza taking over. He makes an argument that there are significant changes in that lineup. I'll read the MMCs for you, but first, take a listen to this conversation I had with the mayor a short while ago. Thank you so much for making time for us, and congratulations, Mayor. Welcome to the Midday Report.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Doctor, let's start here. What does your election as mayor mean for, I suppose, yourself as an individual, but most importantly, for citizens in Ekurhuleni?
Well, I think it means a lot. In fact, I'm humbled, you know, with the opportunity to lead the city, but importantly, to be voted for unopposed. I think it goes a lot in terms of the confidence that council has got in my leadership. But importantly, the need, you know, to stabilize and actually to deliver services for our people. I think I've been given, you know, an opportunity by our communities, but also by our movement to, you know, be part of a Gurlene Council that is since 2011. I was still in the youth ranks in the ANC Youth League. I've been given various, you know, opportunities to actually lead during Mayor Mondlie. I was MMC of Energy and Water, which is a critical service delivery function, but also in terms of the infrastructure built, and that's an exposure to those critical functions. During Mayor Masina, I was looking after finance and economic development, which are critical functions in terms of the financial sustainability, but also the growth and development of the city. You get to see what it means, the contribution of this great region in the regional economy, in the provincial GDP, or Gauteng GDP, in the country's GDP, and what is the role that municipalities they have to actually play in enabling you know, investment and all that. But importantly, the governance issues, I had to look after corporate. So I'm saying it's a combination of functions that has given me the exposure, the experiences, and I hope I'm committed that all these attributes that I've actually indicated will go a long way in actually ensuring that we drive the city forward, we drive delivery that is impactful.
Sure. Let's look at the latest development. Yesterday, you announced your 10 members of the mayoral committee. What considerations went into the men and women who will support you in delivering services to citizens?
Yeah, I think for me, what the first thing was you know, an appreciation that council has given us a responsibility, and that the Municipal Systems Act, Structures Act, Section 60, bestows the overall leadership on the, in terms of powers and functions, on the executive mayor. So I think that is an important aspect. That is why you are then called an executive mayor, because you've got an overall responsibility, including to ensure that the members of the mayoralty are led, are marshaled to the right thing. And I want to use the word marshal, because that's what our communities want. They want a demonstration by the leadership that we'll be able to pull the two team together to do what is right, that the principles of non-partisan will have to come in. So the fact that we do not have the sufficient numbers, it meant we must consult widely. We must speak to all the parties in council, you know, others. Of course, you must balance decision-making in going forward. Others, they elected not to participate in the executive, they will participate in the legislature to actually play greater oversight. Others elected to participate. So it is a contribution by different parties, but importantly, the overall responsibility lies with the executive mayor, and I think that is the duty we're prepared to take.
I want you to take a quick listen to something for me. In fact, I want you to take a listen to yourself, Doctor, and some of the comments you've made, and then I just want to unpack that very quickly. Please just take a quick listen.
We have called for a change or reconfiguration of the current arrangement so that it actually assists in the delivering of services you know, to our people. And as things stands, as you could, you know, see in the last, you know, council meeting, where basically there were disruptions of councils by the councillors from the EFF. And it is such a conduct that is also reflecting in the manner in which the EFF are discharging their responsibilities, in the manner in which they are cooperating in this arrangement. And we feel that we need leadership. Our people, our communities, they need leadership, they need services. In the areas of finance, you know, a lot needs to be desired. In the areas of governance, in the areas of the provision of basic services, and that is why, you know, there's a strong call for this change. And if there is no commitment to change, you know, our, you know, councillors, our structures, our communities are asking us, why are we remaining in this type of an arrangement?
Mayor, that was you speaking to the SABC. How do you explain to citizens how your mayoral committee prominently features EFF councillors after comments you've made in public about what it's like to have them in leadership positions? How do you explain that they continue to preoccupy, to occupy rather, that crucial finance portfolio?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think what we must say, you know, emphasize our call has been one, a change or reconfiguration and a commitment and leadership, if you underline some of those words. And that's why I referred to the functions and powers of the executive mayor, which lies in the executive mayor. The little has been said about the mayoral committee in the legislation. Now, the mayoral committee are there to assist, to support the executive mayor to drive. There is no executive authority in MNCs. The executive authority is in the mayor. Now, that is important. And that is where leadership comes. That is where you get commitment. That is where we talk about a common program and a commitment to that common program. And that is important because you serve as an MMC of finance at the behest of the executive mayor. There are critical functions that we had to put forward in the areas where we have been. We have to focus on the financial sustainability program. You need leadership there. You need to ensure that the partners that are coming to the table, they understand that need. You know, that is a focus area. Mm. You need to ensure that you know, some of the critical principles that our forebears, that the democracy that we enjoy today, that our communities enjoy, is assurance. You know, Chapter 9 institutions, they come to give us, they are an assurance provider. You can't be at loggerheads with a auditor general, for instance. And that is leadership. It comes from the top. And we are here today, we're given an opportunity to actually marshal everybody to understand. And everyone in this team had to commit, the parties that involved had to commit to some of these attributes. And that's what is fundamental.
So looking at...
And let me just go and further expand. I mean, there are areas where we'll further articulate as we go to the State of the City's address in terms of... how we'll be unpacking our focus in the area of finance to turn things around. But if you look at the critical service delivery areas, we've gone, we've unbundled, for instance, energy and water into two different, there's a new MMC now, Zaifani Ngwenya is going to be driving energy to ensure that there's maximum focus and that there is the necessary agility of responding and communicating. Creating a to our people. So I'm saying there are changes. If you look at how we've consolidated the regional economy program, the real estate program is now into city development and economic development, so that you create a one-stop shop for investors. As they come, you know, there's one stop shop. There is whether is development, whether it's zoning, whether it's issues of access to some of the economic development packages, including the land. You don't have to be running around from one area to the other. And there's some of the things that it's a change that we've been talking about. And I really think that we have to give the executive mayor support that indeed we will get this team to pull together, to be seamless in doing their work, to actually focus on the areas of service delivery in a non-partisan way.
I'm trying to wrap up. I'm almost done, Mr. Mayor. So when we look at this composition, because you're also the ANC chair and the convener in the region, and we think, geez, the EFF is outwits the ANC. That is unfair and it's an incorrect assertion from where you stand?
Definitely. We've got the mayor. I think that is fundamental. Never downplay the authority, legislated authority that has been given to the mayor. The Municipal Structures Act pronounces the mayor, no one else. And I have a team, if the team does not move the way we want it to move, I don't have to consult anybody to actually ensure that consequences. This thing, if we don't get it right with the team that we're putting together, we would not be able to get the administration to focus. And I think that is what we must emphasize. Going forward, we need a culture. We need a team that is focused. The leadership of the executive mayor is always critical. And one thing that we must assure our communities, we'll have to rise to actually ensure everybody toes the line.
Thank you so much. You've actually answered my last question. Very quickly, people keep asking me, "Ki doctor or easy doctor or easy a doctor?" And we call him Kwasi Diphine. People are asking me what we ought to call you. Very quickly, I said to them, "I know you as doctor, full stop."
Yeah, no, that's my name. Kwasi Diphine, Dr. Xhakaza. But Dr. Xhakaza is what generally we grew up being called. This is what at home they use Kwasi Diphine.
And we use doctor.
So you can use,
that's how we know you.
Name. Dr. Xhakaza and Kwasi Diphine Xhakaza, both names.
All right. Thank you so much for your time, Mayor. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks a lot for the opportunity.
So that's the new Ekurhuleni mayor, Dr. Xhakaza. I'm seeing a lot of your WhatsApps, a lot of reaction to that interview. Sabizinto says, new Ekurhuleni mayor is talking hogwash. For them to bring back EFF as MMCs in Ekurhuleni shows that all what they said over the past few weeks are lies. They don't want to lose Joburg City because that's what the EFF threatened to do. Joburg has a big budget and they sacrificed Ekurhuleni. Aliki D says, Zamazamas, overflowing sewage in the streets, garbage everywhere, stolen cables, ruined cables. This is service delivery in Ekurhuleni. I always say, and I say it quite often, I'm a resident of the 10th province, that's Ekurhuleni, and I also worry about the deterioration of the city. You can send us a voice note to WhatsApp, 072-702-1702, 072-567-1567. He says he has the executive authority. Do you believe he can exercise it?
Because this journey is better taken together.
Let's walk the talk. 702.
It's 9:01. We turn our attention now to the conflict that's been unfolding in the Middle East. Israel has vowed to respond to Iran's weekend attack. This on the back of the global calls for restraint. Our very own president at the weekend saying these are the worst of his fears. President Ramaphosa again calling for cool heads and for talks as a way forward. The UN Security Council has also pronounced itself on this, yet fears that things can get worse remain. We speak now to Tembisa Fakude, a senior research fellow and director at Africa Asia Dialogues. Tembisa, good afternoon. Thank you so much for your time. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
There's a lot of division, Tembisa, on what comes next. Some arguing that the entire region will soon be engulfed in what's essentially Israeli-Palestinian conflict, while others argue that Iran has made its point. What is your sense? And if you can, very briefly, talk about how we got to where we are now with this current conflict.
I don't think Israel is going to respond because its allies, particularly the U.S. and the other Western countries have said they're not going to support Israel if it does retaliate to what happened on Saturday. So, although, of course, the Israeli government has insisted that they are going to respond, but the position at the moment is not very clear. we heard from Benny Gantz, who's part of the war cabinet, saying they will respond at their own time in a certain manner. So we'll have to wait and see what's going to happen there. Iran had no choice but to retaliate after its embassy or its consulate was attacked by Israel on April the 1st, even though Israel, of course, did not claim the attack, but we all know, and we all know who did it. It was Israel who did it. So Iran had to respond because, one, domestically, they were under pressure. Iranians wanted to see an action because the embassy in Damascus is a of Iran. That's one. Number two is also in terms of, you know, the normal international practice. Countries have got the right to defend themselves, and that's also sanctioned by the, you know, UN, all the protocols that UN has. So it had to respond on Saturday. So that's why it responded. But Iran has also emphasized that should Israel decide to retaliate on following what happened on Saturday, they are going to respond even much more harsher than they did on Saturday.
Before I even speak about the fears around what else could happen in the region, I want to go back slightly. You mentioned how some of those allies who supported Israel have actually said that they won't. But what about the optics, though, of having a war cabinet meeting in 24 hours? Does that matter? Should we worry? Should Israel be behaving in a different way to try and manage how people are watching it going back and forth and negotiating and deliberating on the way forward?
Well, it does matter because it means that the war cabinet is divided. You've got some cool heads, at least at the moment, emerging from the war cabinet, people such as Benny Gantz, who are against Benjamin Netanyahu, but also Benny Gantz is also ambitious of becoming the next prime minister of Israel. They understand that Benjamin Netanyahu would like to escalate the current tensions so that he can remain relevant in Israeli politics and prolong his prime ministership. You know for sure, you know, for example, that there are ongoing protests inside Israel calling for the resignation of Benjamin Netanyahu. So this is one of his tactics of trying to remain relevant. So if he starts a war with Iran, obviously he will be able to prolong his tenure and even go beyond what's been suggested as the next election date in Israel, which is September. So he wants action, and whatever it takes for him to remain in power, he will do so. But I think he's facing a lot of pressure from within the war cabinet, particularly because Israel is on a back foot when it comes to Gaza, given all of the violations that have been recorded so far.
So from your perspective, the fears that the entire area region will be engulfed in conflict is actually unfounded, and that we shouldn't be worried at that level. Again, it goes back to your first point earlier that the optics kind of say no more action will be taken by Iran, at least for now, and Israel doesn't have the backing of those who've been on its side all along.
That's true. And you also have to remember that before Iran launched those missiles, 300-plus so missiles, on Saturday, it had forewarned countries such as the United States and others that it was going to be. So this was agreed in inverted commas that Iran had to do what it had to do. That's one. Number two is, if you look at the chaos that ensued hours after the announcement was made, you had interruption of the airline and flights in the region, with many airline companies avoiding the airspaces of at least Iraq, Jordan, Israel and other neighboring countries. So the chaos that ensued as a result of that, one. Two is, you also have a possibility of interruption of energy supplies, particularly oil and gas. So these countries are aware of this, but importantly, and very few people talk about this, is the popularity of this war and the continuation of this war within Israel. You know, on Saturday, it was a mega terror moment for Israelis. All of them, well, most of them had to go into bunkers, schools were suspended. And I don't think the Israelis want to live under that, you know, constant shadow and worry of Iranian attack. The trauma. So there are pushbacks on various fronts. One, business is going to push back. Two is just politics. And I don't think the Israelis have got appetite. But finally, Israel, I don't think, can sustain a war on all of these fronts. They've got Houthis in the Red Sea, for example. You've got Hezbollah, you've got Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and other factions within both Palestinians at the moment, which is Gaza and the West Bank. You've got Hezbollah, you've got Iraq and Syria. So Israel, I don't think it will be able to sustain and protect itself from all of these fronts. The fact that it had to invite countries such as the UK, France, and the United States to assist it on Saturday tells you that they cannot survive by themselves.
And lastly, Tembisa, I just want to pick at the issue of the United Nations. A lot of the conversations are, no, leave it to the United Nations to deal with it. We've seen Benjamin Netanyahu pretty much ignoring instructions and guidance from the United Nations. What does the United Nations then do, particularly in the case of Israel, where calls for restraint, again, haven't really been listened to properly, cool heads haven't been listened to properly. What does that also do to brand United Nations and what it ought to do, the role it ought to play in terms of peacekeeping across nations?
Well, the United Nations has lost its power, its influence and relevance. The fact that we've got this P5, or permanent five members of the Security Council, have got the right to veto whatever decisions are taken by the community of nations. Again, in disempowered the United Nations. So there's nothing really we should expect from the United Nations. The main power broker in this conflict is the United States. If the United States decides, for example, to sanction Israel by withholding the aid and support that it gives to Israel, this war will be over today. But Israel, of course, the United States continues to support Israel, giving it the wherewithal to continue bombarding and suppressing the rights of the Palestinians and killing the thousands of Palestinians as we have seen. So United States is becoming the main player, and it's the United States that can decide what to do, not United Nations anymore.
All right, thank you so much. That's Tembisa Fakude, Senior Research Fellow and Director at Africa-Asia Dialogues. As he speaks about the U.S., I just spent some time in Ohio and in Las Vegas, and let me tell you, in their own elections, the presidential elections in November, the issues in the Middle East are a massive talking point. Reproductive rights are massive. Paycheck issues are massive. But what is happening in Gaza is a huge talking point, and it's lost Biden, Joe Biden, a lot of support amongst the Democrats. How that will play itself out remains to be seen. But definitely, the Middle East conflict is top of mind for many Americans.